Who would have thought that we would make it to the last session with so many not having withdrawn from the course? So I'm absolutely delighted. One possible reward in the making is a memo I just got. Says the Irving Overman Memorial Award in the amount of $3,800 will be awarded this year at graduation to the student writing the best paper relating to the topic of the internet and the law. Professor Charles Nesson will oversee the award and prize. This is the man to be. The deadline for submission of paper for the prize is Tuesday, May 1st, 2001. Write your calendars down. You should give them to the LA Office, the Dean's Office. So perhaps one of the papers, I don't know, I assume they'll allow the group papers to qualify for the prize.
Yes, they will.
We run it, so group papers counts as well. I see no reason why this is my initial glimpse of the papers, which I hope you're happy now are behind you, but ahead of you. Many of these would be worthy contenders, vis-a-vis at least each other, for the prize. So I wish you all luck in winning the prize. Also, vis-a-vis, you know, the usual criteria, obviously, just these things. So, all right, I'm very appreciative of the efforts that we went to, many of you, to answer the optional rotisserie questions. And some of you, because you didn't notice it was optional. The optional rotisserie questions for this week on sort of pieces to help wrap up what has been a, what have I called before, a kaleidoscopic view of internet issues as they have come and gone. Ben has returned for a triumphant takeover. He suggested that he could do a real-time rotisserie with himself, raising the computer, reacting to everything. But instead of that, I served him up with three PowerPoint shows displayed on all of the screens. And the real test would be if Ben knows which slide to advance at which time. I have no recollection of what I've done with any of them. So with that, why don't we take a look? Yes, I think we might as well start today with where we ended yesterday, which was with Don's visit, which I hope was fairly illuminating and all too brief, unfortunately, because he was just starting to really dig into it. And I hope you come to appreciate what a formidable foe Don is as a negotiating partner, just hearing how he strategized his way through what, by many accounts, was a successful conclusion to his commission's process. So here are some of the lingering questions I had trying to abstract upwards from Don's visit. This is a bill, a slide of bills. Yeah, there we go, a bill. Question one, why did Congress appoint a commission? It's not like it appoints them every day. Why did it want a commission on this subject? You know, normally it either passes a law or it doesn't. And indeed, on a number of internet issues, we've seen the United States Congress tempted to appoint a commission of some kind. Internet tax comes to mind, it's another big commission, one that was much more rife with controversy. It never came together the way Don's did. I had some surmise on that point. The obvious answer, at least one obvious answer, is that a problem is just too hard, too technical for Congress to deal with. So it pumps it to a commission, which can judiciously dig into the problem and look at it. And you might start, if you believe that, to think that a lot of cyber law problems might lend themselves to it. Indeed, this class has been, at times, a struggle at the survey level to figure out how far to delve into the technology in order to figure out the political or legal or social implications of it. So in a way, this is Congress's way of having a tech review session scheduled at a time convenient to everyone, unlike what we managed. But for those who attended, I understand it's helpful. Okay, so that's one possibility. There's another, which is that the action they want to take is too sensitive or politically difficult to accomplish. And the classic example might be the base closing commission, right? That's the commission that looks at armed forces installations around the country. Deals with a highly technical issue of, you know, whether we still need a cavalry regiment in the Ozarks anymore, or if we can finally declare that territory, of integrity and safe and not subject to attack. There we have a sense it's not that it's, you know, hard issues in a technical sense, it's just hard issues in a political sense. Nobody actually wants to be the one responsible for closing a base in a given area, as we know, military votes. And thus, we pumped it to a commission. It's a hands-tying exercise. And then we do the same commission did it and, you know, issue press releases as they do it, saying how terrible their decisions are, while secretly happy that they're doing what they're doing. So maybe those are two operative things in the COBA commission sense, but it still leads to another question, which is why act at all? I mean, what's the pressure to even have a commission? Why not just sit on it? If it's too technically complicated and too sensitive, do what Congress wants to do, and indeed what a good substantive plurality of this class wanted to do yesterday, which was do absolutely nothing. And I hypothesized this class the beginnings of an answer to that question, which was on the screen, they started over here, depending on what Penn is doing. Ah, yes. So here on this screen, we have some reasons why Congress would be tempted to act, even if it seems that something is difficult or sensitive. I think actually there's also one more thing to appear on the Don's slide. Not that I was wrong, you were right. There we have a number of parties over here. You know what? I think you should want to go to the next slide in the middle. This is quite confusing. Yeah, let's talk about Congress's dilemma while a young Jack Valenti stares us down from the right screen. Start walking through this slide. Yes, so the first thing is at all costs, do no harm. That's the idea of let's not act hastily. And that's certainly what Don introduced yesterday as the linchpin of Clinton administration policy, which is not to do anything, if at all possible, as a constructive way of keeping the net broken and unregulated. And indeed, what it reflects is, maybe I should seize this thing. This works a little bit. Let's see if this actually. All right. So it reflects the idea that the internet's moved from this unknown thing, this kind of fun but nerdy thing, to the core U.S. economic engine, real or perceived. Certainly, there's this idea now that if we rain on the internet parade, we could all be in big trouble. You know, even senators from the rural South seem to get this now. They don't know what the internet is, but they know they're not supposed to touch it. It ain't broken, so they're not going to fix it. But then on the other hand, we have this shift from the unknown to ubiquity that causes some serious problems, some among people who are well organized. And that's what leads us to Jack Valenti over here. And indeed, Jack Valenti has a company. This was sort of what we spent a couple weeks of the class going over. Jack Valenti, the Recording Industry Association of America, ASCAP, all of them. This is Metallica off in the corner, seething about the way that copyright is being abused on the net. And on the other side of things, we have, among others, who we have. Yes, we have the class. And I don't mean institutionally the class, although I know some of you have harbored a suspicion that I am secretly communist or anti-copyright in some way. I don't know why, and I hope my donning of the Warner Brothers jacket is finally dispelled any myth in that regard. But I mean by this that not the class institutionally, but individually. Pretty much everybody in this class fessed up to using Napster, and they pretty much said they thought it was wrong. This was Valenti's point about his visit to Stanford, where he was so disappointed with kids these days, because they said they knew it was wrong, and yet they happily engaged in copyright infringing, or at least stealing, whether it's copyright infringement or not, activity anyway. And there have been a couple others on the other side of things as well, in addition to the class. There's Prince, for example, or the artist formerly known as Prince, who was starting to see that maybe this is a way of cutting out those parties at the top that used to be his gatekeeper to get people like us. And in the middle, looking for a spooky is Stephen King. And Stephen King was in the middle because he's actually been a wonderful, he couldn't ask Central Casting a better example of an artist who is on the fence about this technology, right? His first venture into the electronic was that glass book reader, Riding the Bullets, for which you couldn't print the thing. It was a case study of trusted systems in action. And what was his second foray into electronic publishing but his story, The Plant, which was, hey, click here, give me money, forget the publisher, and I'll just write and put it up on my website, which has been spectacularly successful, even though perhaps a little suspense. Stephen King has recently announced that he was putting the plant on the back burner and working on a real book. So you have that kind of thing. And also filling in the bottom here is iPayTV, JumpTV.com. You might remember a little bit about this from Jurisdiction Day. Some entrepreneurs who are finding ways of taking what had been fairly stable business models and methods of getting copyrighted material out there, in their case, television broadcasts, the third rail of copyright sensitivity for the copyright and publishing industries. And we're starting to package that into an internet window, put ads around the corners, and thereby raise the ire of Jack Valenti and the TV types. So that's the situation you have going, and now I think we're in the middle still. How had the copyright people been dealing with this originally? Well, here's an example of how they managed to do it, right? They just sort of honed legislation to figure out how to cut up the pie. This was in the era in which it looked like digital audio tape recorders were going to be all the rage, and people were worried that the use of these DATs would eat into record sales, as you could make, or CD sales, as you could make perfect DATs. And thus did they insist that those who make DATs put in chips so that the DATs would refuse to copy a copy. They won't copy a digital tape to make a new copy. And in addition, there'll be a tax on DAT machines and a tax on blank tapes. This is reminiscent of the tax on pornography to pay for rating, that kind of thing. So there's going to be a tax on this stuff, $2 or $3 per unit of the thing, and then Congress lays it right out. Here it is in the U.S. Code, 66 2/3% of the royalty go to a certain fund, and 2 5/8 of that go into a special escrow account, and 1 3/8%. So they had one way of dealing with this when they thought the genie was still in the bottle. And even now, as it looks like webcasting may be the future, you'll start to listen to your favorite music through a broadcast of some kind, or better put, maybe a narrowcast or person cast, but it will be something that doesn't come off of a spinning object that you own that reifies the data, but instead comes from a relationship you have with a record company, or is it a record company, with somebody that gives you digital music and you can listen to it. Now, we had talked about, and this is getting into, well, I shouldn't even try the laser pointer here. I guess it doesn't really work on the screen, so somebody should file a report. Okay, so next to Jack Valenti is the RIAA and ASCAP, two, I don't call them pigs, at the trough that had had a regular way of slurping up some of the economic value that there was to be had for the creative content that people wanted. And right, ASCAP were the radio people. I guess played on the radio, wore under certain conditions in restaurants, and ASCAP gets the money and gives it back to songwriters. RIAA is the record industry. You put it on a record and you make mechanical reproductions of that record, RIAA gets a big chunk of that. That was the way it happened to divvy up as a way reflected in copyright law of the mechanical right of reproduction versus the performance right, going back to the time when there were performances of string quartets playing on machine music. And you had these two organizations. And how did that manage to advance in the middle? Yes. So here you have then Congress stepping in and saying, okay, it's possible then that the advent of the web and of broadband and of music going digital will just get rid of records. You're not going to use them anymore. You'll know that your collection, such as it is, exists on a server somewhere, you have rights to it, and you'll play it. That's bad news for the RIAA. That's one future that could put them out of business. So they're not out of business because it turns out that a digital broadcast of something over the web is now by fiat said to implicate both the reproduction right and the performance right, and they just have to figure out how to balance the money between them. And if they can't agree, we have a copyright arbitration royalty panel that'll figure out, and here, this is just wonderful, this is at 17 U.S.C. 114 F2B I2 little I, and you'll see here it says, whether use of the service may substitute or may promote sales of photo records or otherwise may interfere with or may enhance the sound recording, copyright owners, other streams of revenue from sound recordings. There it is, very deep in the law to be sure, but a bold statement. This is like the buggy whip manufacturer saying, you know what, there is a future in which people won't need buggy whips. So there's another thing that's going to get sold, call them automobiles, for which the sales of buggy whips, it may interfere with them, or may substitute for them. Let's give a royalty to the buggy whip makers to make sure that they don't go out of business, because after all, they have interests too. Now, I concede, and you're getting by popular request, or my personal view of this session, that you might have in past sessions, I don't hold against the record companies. I like Lily Rosen. She's a nice person. And they're doing what comes naturally. I think I've said before in this class, it's like the Soviet Union, right? The military and the Soviet Union, they can always be trusted to act exactly in their self-interest. And it makes them a stable and understandable negotiating partner for which you can understand their role in the world and their likely reactions to things and how they figure in by not hating them, by simply understanding, hey, you know, you were their lawyer, as you may one day soon be. This is exactly what you're going to do too. And indeed, that was the message Valenti gave us when put to it by Lessig, who's invoking these high-minded principles. You know, well, he says, look, business is business, and stealing is stealing, and stealing is what Congress says it is. And so, you know, what do you want from me? That's the end of the day, what's going on. So I believe it. Yes, we have the whole picture of people on the ground. There's a reason for that. Because it turns out that the other point of inflection has been going from just a few people implicated by this stuff, where maybe you can still keep the lid on it, into the masses. Suddenly these clueless people are themselves partaking of the internet and themselves figuring out how to use Napster. This time last year, I asked my class to get onto Napster and download a song, and no one could do it. And it's not because they're dumber than you are, although I don't know if I would put their papers in for the special prize. But it just wasn't quite there yet. Connections weren't fast enough. It was just harder to figure out how to download the thing, how to get it working, and this has changed. Of course, this year people had a lot of trouble with Nutella trying to figure out how that could work. This time next year, I think it's quite possible, unless something exactly the opposite happens, the Nutella will be quite easy to use. And we're going to talk about that other contingency shortly. But it's this fact, the fact that we're going to huge crowds of people that are now migrating to the internet, or having the internet migrate to them, that is going to make a huge difference in the tenor of the debate, the urgency of the debate, and again, it points us back to why Congress and others around the world are being asked to act and act quickly. What's next? Yes. So this is something I just coined, so I take some responsibility for calling it this, although it's an idea that's been around for a while. Professor Nesson is one of the disciples, I believe. And I call this the principle of conservation of legal dissonance. How does that sound? You like learned something today. Principle of conservation of legal dissonance. When the law is easy to break, and good people see no reason not to break it, law itself is threatened. If you are in the position, think of yourself as Don Palach. You have no particular personal views. You're just trying to share the world. And you want things to work out pretty nicely. So you're in charge, value-neutral-wise, of just running a legal system that works, that people respect, for which the laws are obeyed, that, you know, the law gets passed and then you can enforce it. And you realize that when the law is easy to break, and good people, or maybe just substitute for that, most people, see no reason not to break it. They think of it as malum prohibitum instead of malum insane. It's like a parking ticket kind of thing. That law itself is threatened. The more you have this going on, the more law is brought into disrepute, the more shrill you try to make the law and make up for it, perhaps, but the more you ultimately lose, and people start getting restless when the law isn't being obeyed. Think about the feeling you get when you think you're standing in line at a place that forks into multiple lines at the end. There's like three cashiers in one line, and that way, whoever moves first, you get to go to. And then somebody kind of walks up next to the line and stands to your left. And you're trying to decide whether to make a preemptive strike and say, no, I'm waiting for that person. But then, of course, the person on the right goes, somebody behind you will go around you. Yeah, there's a whole social interplay that goes on when you wait in these somewhat undefined lines. And the minute somebody comes up on the left, and perhaps the person in front of you was really the person with standing to make a claim, you're just one person behind, doesn't say anything, and then they get to go, and a few people behind you go to that, and then suddenly there are three lines, you feel this sense of rage, of the tearing of the social fabric, the idea that the world is starting to not hold anymore, right? It's like Gates' second coming. And this is what you can find in certainly a magnifying form, when you have a widespread disregard of law, what is a big deal? Well, law might want to tend to see the path of the least public resistance. Which is to say, if there's any way to interpret the law so that you can make it just work and not have this cleavage between what is supposed to be happening and what really is happening, that's what you as a jurist or as a legislature or as an observer of the political scene may seek to do. Applying before the Supreme Court, this says that they will not be thinking all that hard about what to put in the opinion of which Al Gore suddenly comes from behind and is given an opportunity to spend days recounting ballots that are sitting in higher trusts. That's completely without reference to whether or not Al Gore has a good case. I don't know whether he does. I've actually been working in class rather than watching hours of that testimony. But it does make, again, a sort of empirical prediction about what that court will do, and indeed what often the courts and the legislatures will do. So this is the clock that the copyright interests, just to carry on with that example, are racing against. If too many people start using Napster too easily, there's no way the courts are going to come in and make all of us criminals. They can't do it. And we see that happening in a whole bunch of other areas as well, up on screen stage left, I guess it is, which is to say right screen. We saw with the Ticketmaster and Microsoft dispute, in which Ticketmaster found itself with deep links coming in from sidewalk.com and said, no, we want people to have to come in through the front of Ticketmaster and be subjected to a bunch of ads before they can buy their ticket. And they get into a big fight with Microsoft on the technical side of things, the so-called arms race. And then they go to the court for relief. And it doesn't look like the court's going to be that helpful to them. But what ends up happening anyway is that Microsoft and Ticketmaster do what rational parties just problem maximizing will do. They just come to a handshake, and in fact, Ticketmaster buys Sidewalk from Microsoft. That's the end of the story, and it's now called CitySearch.com, and that's the end of that. So, okay, let's just see some of the other disputes in which we have looked at this. Ah, yes, the old Total News case. Right, that was the site that just framed a bunch of other sites on the net, in the so-called framing protocol. And CNN was one of the sites that so framed. And why was CNN upset? Because at the bottom, Total News had an ad, and they weren't very happy about that. So they go into the big misappropriation claim and went through some of that doctrine of breakneck speed. And again, we find the court is hard-pressed, right? It never reaches a decision. That's unsettling. But the court would have been hard-pressed to actually say that to frame something on the net is to misappropriate under tort law. Because then you've got a bunch of possible tort claims coming down the pipe for anybody that happens to build something that frames. So by our principle of conservation of legal dissonance, we say that's probably not likely to happen. Okay, you keep going. Ah, yes, eBay versus Bidder's Edge. Bidder's Edge being the site that tried to aggregate data from all the auctions at once. They start out rational actors and try to cut a deal. eBay says, wait a minute, you're sending too many robots to check our prices, and we don't want to do it anymore. Bidder's Edge says, too bad, we have a right to check the price like anybody else does. And eBay sues. Right now, eBay has won. eBay has won at the district level in that case. Now, it's unclear what will happen next. But again, I think a lot of the ultimate result of that case, both in that particular case, and looking to can we make some general rule, or be some general practice emerging about robots going in and looking at databases, the actual determinant of that will be how likely is it that lots of people will be seeking to do this and will thereby be made criminals or civilly liable if indeed we find that it is a form of trespass on their server and you're not allowed to do that. Other things we had looked at was the sort of the megaphone problem, right? It's what Melvin Swain was talking a little bit about with Cyber Beach, and that's why Small Town Justice has been hanging out over here on the left. This is a website for which, I'm not even sure I can read it, I'm standing right in front of it, but you might remember this. This was the woman who got pulled over for speeding in California. And thus started an entire website. This is a deep website. You're welcome to take a look at it, smalltownjustice.com. That is pointed up in the middle here. There it is. So she has photos of the guy who pulled her over. Here's the latest on California Highway Patrol Officer Gregory Mason. He cut his life to a process server. Officer Mason, a man over 6 feet tall, over 200 pounds, Knowing that the decision from the appellate court reversing the unconstitutional gag order had been personally served upon him and his wife Val, during the life of the process server, middle-aged female about 5 feet tall with his very large German Shepherd dog. Okay, and then he made a false police report trying to have the process server arrested. Tell his boss you don't want an officer like this patrolling California's highways and carrying a gun. And then she gives a proposal on the board to attorney James P. Mason, the guy that was representing the officer, his countersuit against her. All right, so which side do you fall on? Where are you in that dispute? Well, you can see yourself in either position. You can be the person that got screwed over in some way at a store, and instead of carrying a picket in front of the store all day, you'll say the website about it. Throw some meta tags in there, and when people search for that store, they're going to find out your view on that store. And if some of the people that I can't have their way, there would have been a .sucks top-level domain precisely inviting you for this purpose to set up a website criticizing particular targets of the sort. So you can find yourself enjoying that free speech, or you can find yourself on the other side of the line, of course, being the target of it. Right? Officer Mason calls you and says, you're not going to believe what's happening. I can't sleep at night anymore. I just know that there are thousands and thousands of hits. 704-466. Almost a million people have been subjected to this woman's crazy rantings about my behavior as a highway patrol officer. You feel sorry for him or not? Again, I think the court is going to look at this and, yeah, they'll try to handle it as if it were any other kind of run-of-the-mill case. But underneath the hood is this idea of reaching millions of people with a kind of speech, a kind of reach, from kinds of people that formerly had been quite silent. There was nothing to it anymore. And then finally, another one we could look at, which should pop up any day now. Ah, yes, we have the national problem. So we have the United States of America or China or Estonia. You pick it. Having some interest, and you'll notice these are sorting out left and right a little bit. On the left are sort of those who are wanting to assert control of some kind, and on the right are those who are wanting to fight control of some kind. Amazing, Microsoft, in this example, is on the right side of things. And if there's anything you might generalize about the left versus the right here, not politically speaking, just geographically on this chart, is that on the left you've got the established player. You've got somebody who already has a foothold in the space, and trying to do their best to close the door behind them once they're there. And then somebody is the upstart trying to get started somehow off their coattails a little bit. So we have that going along on the left and the right. At least, I don't know if that works in the Bangkok example, but certainly on the ones above it, it does. And then you have various countries, sovereigns, trying to assert some kind of control of various kinds, whether it's against stalkers or against those who engage in criminal copyright infringement. Whatever it might be, and I guess you call them the crypto anarchists on the right that are going against that control. So as this internet goes mainstream and the crowds are starting to use it, the crowds come back on the other side, but surely there's more. Well, I can talk about that, but are you sure that there shouldn't be more of the open? I give a very clear chart of that. I hear the questions we were asking. Who would want to control behavior on the net? It's okay, we keep going. How might it be done? And why not alter the net itself? That was the slide we saw on day one. And some of the answers to that question then unfolded over the term as to who would want to control behavior on the net. We haven't, today at least, talked so much about how it might be done, except to say sometimes you run to the courts to do it. You ask the courts to maintain the status quo, and the courts then turn out to be limited by this principle of conservation or avoidance of legal dissonance as to how much help they can give you, even as they shrug and say, yeah, I know, but before the internet, this wouldn't have been a problem for you. Gee, I'm really sorry. So thus that we end up with over here our orange blob chart, for which we saw that the range of plausible behavior, which had formerly been on the right, it was the right orange blob of the three, in some form of constraint, thanks to the net, had gone leftwards. There's a lot less constraint on you. You can do a lot more stuff. You can ship more bits around. And indeed, in many cases, that might cross the line, the legal boundary, as to what you were formerly allowed to do. And my claim has been, cross that line too much, there might be an attempt to make that legal boundary become stopped. Crossover, but the law isn't going to suffer it. And that's where you get to those who see this as a second-order problem rather than a first-order problem, people saying, okay, I think we do want to go to the next slide over here. If we could just change the facts on the ground, change the internet itself, we could end up not having to rely on the law to close off that legal boundary. We could get people just into the more constraint zone. And that regresses the battle away from an individual tit for tat on some particular doctrinal issue over here and puts it into a meta battle over the control of the internet itself. And as we evolve to the middle and the latter part of the course, that's exactly what we started to look at, the ways in which the net itself might be coming to evolve to decide whether this future, I say maybe 2001 question mark, with the yellow blob safely to the right for those who are in a particular realm of constraint, to see whether that future can be made to come about. So how would you go about changing the net? I don't know where I found this, but you're just a bug trying to change the net itself, and there you are on the back of the dog, the dog being the internet, of course. So forget about how the internet someone knows you're a dog. I'm saying the internet is a dog. And it's just a question of which part of the internet is the dog and which part is the tail. And to change it seems like a daunting task. But for one thing we know, there are a few leftover things you can do that amount to hacks. On the internet today, there's some learning going on by people as to ways in which they can start to push that control back. You know, somehow we lost that again. You're going to push that blob rightward if you're lying constraint. This is bordercontrol.com, which on the basis of your internet protocol address, those serial numbers have been around for a long time, or on a domain name, which will then resolve, it will try to figure out where you're coming from. So there it is concluded that we are from the United States. JC.org is located in the United States. You start to tack on bordercontrol.com to some internet enterprise, and suddenly you can start that you can start doing a form of zoning so that if you are France and you are really upset about the Nazi memorabilia being trafficked on Yahoo.com and the French people can see it, those goods are out on display in direct contravention to French law, you can tell Yahoo they've got to stop because they can do something like border control, not to do it perfectly. There are some Nazi lovers who are going to find a way to get to the stuff, but to keep the honest middle part of the population honest and not have them tempted to go after stuff that they're not supposed to go after. So you'll notice that according to the principle of legal dissonance, the French court, before ordering Yahoo not to display Nazi memorabilia auction items to the French, made sure that this could work. They have their staff of three experts go away, a commission of the sort, and come back and tell them, yeah, they can pretty much do it. At which point the court turned around and said, okay, pretty much do it. And we may see a lot more of that coming around. And as digital certificate technology gets better, as we looked at, we saw ways in which we won't just start slicing and dicing on geography, thanks to some happenstance facts about the way that internet protocol addresses are allocated. But instead, we'll start to see digital certificates able to certify all sorts of things about ourselves with the help of third parties. So we can start certifying our age and things like that. We saw COBOC. The COBOC Commission took a look at age check IDs and weren't all that interested in them for a number of reasons. I think that could potentially change a lot in a short period of time as the technology gets better. Okay, which of the three screens moves next? So here are some of the other institutional creatures we saw that might be in a position to change the direction of the internet, because they're the ones who are behind it to begin with, right? You'll recognize IANA, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. That was John Postel, that was one guy. Then you have the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, the Internet Society. This is pretty much bearded again, mostly from the United States, some in Europe, some scattered around the rest of the world, that have been the ones responsible for the construction of internet protocols as we know them. They still believe they are responsible for this. They are merely going along thinking that they will be the source of internet protocol version 6, which is just starting to get unwrapped. They think they're the ones who will be behind it. Now, realizing some of the pressure, they also created the Internet Society. Here's the Internet Society's mission: to assure the open development, evolution, and use of the internet for the benefit of all people throughout the world. So a fascinating mission statement for the Internet Society. I believe they boast somewhere on the order of 10,000 members right now. They have a membership target, I think, of 100,000 or 200,000 by the end of the year 2000. If you want to help them, I urge you to join. They have a staggered fee system growing by country, so that those in Ghana pay much less than those in the United States. That might be one creative thing to do. But as we saw these various entities at work, one thing we saw was that what made them most effective was when they were just by themselves. They were just the engineers talking about engineering, not worrying about the politics of things. And what my screen's moving. So we see the cloud makes a return, and that is the table screen. Right, so here we are on the left and the right. Here's our internet cloud diagram, and then the red box is zoomed in on this monitor. I'm never doing this again. This monitor has a zoom in of the box, and you see the elements of the operating system. So if you were just trying to approach this as a person from Mars, say, all right, here's an internet out there. How are we going to change it? This is your patient on the operating table. This is where you would be seeking to make interventions. Somewhere along this path, and the characters behind it, the protocols to maintain it, or somewhere here, if enough of the nodes of the net run on common software or hardware, you can make changes here and thus affect changes to the internet. So that's sort of the candidates. We already have these guys sort of tinkering under the hood, making the next generation. But as this stuff got political, in other words, as the crowds arrived, we had to find some kind of escape valve. I think I'm going to go on, right? We definitely want to back that up. Okay, so ICANN. ICANN was one of the first attempts by the techie guys to just punt to somebody else, create a playpen, and put nice steel bars around it. They can have their domain name system, just don't ruin the parts that we already have, and let them fuss with it all they want. It'll keep them distracted. In the meantime, we can start doing things like Internet Protocol version 6, stuff like that. And ICANN, I suppose, if that's what you thought was charted to be, I would say it's been a success. It still exists, something that was not to be taken for granted until quite recently. And it has just completed a process by which it has authorized a number of new top-level domains to come about. That was one of the two big problems that was created and solved, the other being the trademark problem and so-called cyber squatting. They have also made progress, and progress is what you want to call it, on that. There have been thousands of actions brought under ICANN's trademark dispute resolution policy in the 6 months or 8 months that it has been in existence. So there are a number of people who would call that a success. ICANN has been off doing it. Now, is ICANN a success with a capital S? I don't know. There was a time when I thought that the purpose of ICANN would be to take these leading edge issues, not particularly sexy to be sure. It takes a while, right? It took 90 minutes in our first session to really get into why you should care about the domain name test. And I'm still not sure I've pumped all of you into the idea that you should really care about it. But ICANN has not necessarily been a new kind of governance. It's been a non-collage kind of governance. It's been the usual suspect characters, the 200 people or so around the world who cared enough to begin with, jostling around. There's this membership now, thousands of members, I think over 100,000 members of ICANN, most of whom, my guess is, don't know they have members of ICANN. At some point, they fill out a form, but all they knew was a Republican absentee ballot application, but instead it was a chance to join ICANN, and they pulled a crank, virtually speaking, of course, and elected somebody to this organization. They don't know what it does. Now, I agree that one upshot of much of this exposure of the technical as being driving the policy, right? That's the orange blob point. If you move that orange blob around, you get to where you want to go, regardless of what the law says, and then the law's going to have to follow you. So it is that important. He said that ICANN was meant to be this broad, representative, self-governing body, with its membership being the internet users at large. It's clearly not that. And I don't know that it ever could be. So in one sense, a success, in one sense, a failure. I don't know how many of you are planning to join ICANN even coming out of this course. And if you're not willing to do it, as people have been exposed to it and sort of given the alarmist tirade about it, I have no idea how somebody just untie and unveil it for the first time, is going to want to join and participate in any way as well. There were some other things we looked at. There was, of course, our data male abuse prevention system, Paul Dixie's black hole. Paul Dixie being one of the guys, although he's not here, that runs a lot of the technical stuff that happens on the hood of the internet. And that's him taking a stab at clearly a non-technical problem. Now, he might call over, because, you know, spam clogs email servers, and in short, often when done, matches a million, it does. But it's clear that he's doing this because it's like it's a war of love for him. And that's not an oxymoronic phrase. It's something he's doing because he really does just hate the idea that some of these masses are advertising stupid products to him in the middle of the day and wasting his time. So he's spent much of his time creating apps and endowed for millions of dollars a year and trying to do something about it. And thanks to his place in the technical community, it has actually become quite effective, as at least effective in the sense that if you get listed, again, your stuff doesn't go so far. Here is the ISTM. Just when you thought there were no more acronyms left, we come up with the Internet Societal Task Force. I am not making this up. BitSurf decided that the ISTF was maybe the next step. And I think what might have come from that, maybe I think each of these has BitSurf's RFC. That one. Here is RFC 2468. You can read it up there on that screen. That BitSurf wrote. October 1998, it's called I Remember IAMA. Status of this memo. This memo provides information for the internet community. It does not specify an internet standard of any kind. Remembrance. A long time ago, a network far, far away, a great adventure took place. Out of the chaos of new ideas for communication, the experiments, the tentative designs, and crucible testing, there emerged a cornucopia of networks. Beginning with the ARPANET, an endless stream of networks evolved and ultimately were interlinked to become the internet. Someone had to keep track of all the protocols, the identifiers, networks and addresses, and ultimately the names of all the things in the network's universe. And someone had to keep track of all the information erupted with volcanic force and the intensity of debates and discussions, and endless invention is continuing unabated for 30 years. That someone was Jonathan B. Postel, our internet assigned numbers authority, friend, engineer, confidant, leader, icon, and now first of the giants to depart from this. John, our beloved IAMA, is gone. Even as I write these words, I cannot quite grasp this stark fact. We almost lost him once before in 91. Surely the new news of this is on me all. But he had been our rock, the foundation upon which our every web search and email was built. Always there to mediate the random dispute, to remind us that our documentation did not do justice to the subject, to make difficult decisions with apparent ease, and to consult when careful consideration was needed. We will survive our loss and we will remember. He has left a monumental legacy for all internauts to contemplate. Steadfast service for decades, moving when others seem paralyzed, always finding the right course in a complex minefield of technical and sometimes political obstacles. His remembrance goes on, but you sense in what he writes a feeling that the internet he knew and loved is fast going away. And he wants to persevere and fight on and be part of this fight, I take to be the creation of the Internet Societal Task Force. Vint is the guy behind that, just as he was really the guy behind the Internet Society and the Internet Engineering Task Force as well. He was one of the four that were really the big movers. So he started the ISTF, I think intending it to be what I was saying ICANN has not managed to be. A place where the engineers, the policy people, and the neo-libertarians could get together and talk about stuff, safely away from the techies of the IETF, but still in some plenary form, trying to come to agreement on what the internet of tomorrow should look like. When the internet of tomorrow is built in a distributed fashion, you just don't have a single company doing it. You are left with this vacuum, particularly when government doesn't want to step in and fill it either. So BitSurf standing alone with his tribe, one thing I encourage you to do coming out of this class is check out the ISTF. I think what you'll discover is it's quite thin. There's a website, there's not much more. There's a news page, there's not much news, except for the most recent elections have been held, and some new people have been elected to the ISTF. All right, they're perpetuating themselves, that's a start. But as to what they're actually doing, I think these well-placed lawyers, thinking good thoughts, rather than being sent there on a particular mission, could actually make a huge difference to their work. to provide some model for self-governance that I can certainly not able to do because of other effects that the road. Okay, these are some of the guys in the middle. As we look back over, just one more click over here, I think. Yeah, back to our chart over here. Right, if it's the internet guys, the IETF and stuff, trying to affect stuff as to how the cloud works. We've got the hardware people trying to affect stuff over here, the hardware and software people. We saw a little bit about the Trusted Computing Platform Alliance. IBM, HP, Compaq, Intel, and Microsoft as the founding members, trying to come up with a platform for trusted computing. And we know what trusted computing means now. It means computing for which you can't just act around it. You can say something and it can be sure that that's really the truth, at least as far as some third party that we also trust knows, thanks to the fact that your hardware, if you dare to take a screwdriver to it, not only finds its warranty voided, but melts its internal chip, or in some other ways apologizes for your attempt to screw with it. Here was Time Warner's situation right now. We operate five businesses: cable networks, publishing, music, film entertainment, and cable systems. What a wonderful combination of the infrastructure and the content people behind it. Now again, I've been with Time Warner, I have a jacket to prove it. They swear up and down that they have no intention of particularly synergizing between the infrastructure half of Time Warner and the content half of Time Warner. And I pressed them on this. I said, what do you mean you don't want to synergize? What if it turns out you could make it so that people on Time Warner cable modem cable couldn't use Napster? Just do what Harvard has done. You'll block packets, at least if not incoming, because maybe you'll lose customers that way. At least on outgoing, slow it down. I said, oh, we wouldn't do that. I said, why wouldn't you? What's wrong with you anyway? Want me to buy some stock or not? I mean, clearly, if you are trying to think strategically about how to make these items work together, that's one of the first things you're going to want to do. And indeed, the way the architecture of cable modems works, it's a lot slower to upload than to download. And those variables can change at any time. So when you think that maybe Nutella this time next year is going to be the cast now, you might want to think again, because at least those on cable modems may find that in order to better serve our customers, we're doubling download speeds and we're barring Peter to make all upload speeds are getting cut by 9/10. And thus the spirit of your networking dying just like that for punitive technical reasons that also happen to help one army occupants versus another. You see it even with cable networks. Suppose the Nashville network wants to get into Somerville homes served by Time Warner. They have to pay Time Warner, arrange some way to get Time Warner to carry them on their cable headend. In fact, maybe you've sometimes been subjected to campaigns by the national network or others to get you to call your cable operator and demand that they be added down to your headend. All right, if TNN.com starts going 24 hours live in the national network over broadband, and broadband gets better and better, so it's not a little swing, but soon a big, full-motion audio and video screen of your favorite Nashville hits. You don't need an over Time Warner cable anymore. You've got it on the internet. In fact, you don't need anything over Time Warner cable anymore. You don't need anything over Time Warner cable anymore. Now, if you're Time Warner cable, you're going to take that line down. Speaking as a shareholder, I hope not. You should use everything at your everything to your advantage to find a way not to have one arm of your octopus competing against another, particularly if you've got some quasi-monopolistic position. And thus might we see no guarantee of the quality of service on the internet. You just pass those packets like bucket brigades from one to another. There may be a time in which if you want your national network to get streamed quickly to internet customers in Somerville subscribing to Time Warner Broadband, you've got to pay a particular fee. Otherwise, hey, you're not going to block people from it, but they might find that it doesn't come across quite as clean as it might otherwise. Here's Microsoft.net. What does .NET mean for users and developers? Well, it's a set of building block services for the internet operating system, which will include Passport.net for user authentication, as well as services for file storage, user preference management, calendar management, and many other tasks. It's a whole new way of thinking about the internet if you are to leave Microsoft. Among other things, it is streaming software. No longer will your machine be running programs on it. You'll just be plugged into the mothership, and those programs will be served up to you on an as-needed basis every time you go in. Now, Ben may disagree with me. He has a lot of Microsoft stuff, my knowledge. But this is Microsoft's attempt to take over the world again. They have to keep doing it every so often, because the world does change. DOS wasn't the all the end all. Microsoft Net is their way of trying to make one more grab for the internet. And I don't think it will succeed. I don't know. I can't predict all that well. But it is one attempt. If you can get enough people using these core components, Passport.net for user authentication, Net Enterprise servers that talk only to Net clients of some kind, suddenly you've managed to overlay on top of that wonderful open-to-all internet a proprietary network, which as it becomes more popular, can become more popular, you get feedback effects, and suddenly you'll proprietize the whole thing. Now bless them, that's what, line them up, wash them go, that's what they're supposed to do. Whether or not they'll succeed, I don't know, but this is one possible future internet that could look a lot different than the one we have today. The Pentium 4 is on the way. What will be inside the Pentium 4? Do we care what's inside the Pentium 4? Is it our concern, primarily as law students, what's inside the Pentium 4? This gets a little bit to the point of, if we think that the code is interchangeable with the law, you can impose constraints through software, you can impose constraints through laws, a whole very blessed shit. Well, if we knew it was secret law, law you weren't allowed to see, but that when you broke, you would be informed and punished, we might have some kind of due process-like problem with that. If there were secret code that you're not allowed to see, but then if you transgress against it, you get into trouble. We had a due process problem with that. Not as readily, and yet to the extent that we see this link between the code and the law, it's not clear why we shouldn't. We need to know what's inside the Pentium 4 of our computer as it's doing its thing. When it's sending data back to Intel for performance purposes, do you need to be Oliver Stone to actually worry about what that data is, or demand that that data be shown to you? I want to know what you know. I don't just want you to tell me and say it's an encrypted stream to which I am not entitled. I can't really answer an email over here. What's going on? We're almost there. So here are the open questions. Send us an email, okay? I want to know this. Here are the open questions for left wing. If we can see that the structure of the internet is in flux, what predictions can we make about this next incarnation? I've made some fuzzy ones so far. I'm going to hold myself to it a little bit and make some more concrete ones before our time is through. Second, what are the implications of these predictions? Is it just sort of the Harvard Business School way, hey, who's going to win? Who's going to lose? Where do we place our bets? Or the implications to it that actually bear upon who we are as people. That's what makes the law school different. If they're alarming, what can and how can we know about it, right? That's a Kennedy School kind of question. But they never ask the question there, so we must force ourselves to ask the question on their behalf and give them the answer once we come to it. And finally, it's a sort of a little more reflective in the class, and one that came up in a couple of those, just the answers, is there such a thing as cyber law? Does it make sense, actually, to have a separate class called cyber law, which we've gone through these things? And I've given some answers before, and I'm going to try to give some other answers later. Now, we had one answer to these questions, given at a moment in time. I believe it was February of 1996 in Davos, Switzerland, at the gathering of the World Economic Forum. This is where the CEOs of 1,000 biggest companies in the world gathered. I think it's like Austin Powers 3 or something there. Somebody's going to take over this gathering and hold the hostage. Hasn't happened yet. But they get together and they congratulate themselves on being powerful. And they have panels and sessions about the future of the world, the universe, and how to live forever, stuff like that. And John Gray Barlow went. He was an agent provocateur there, as he is everywhere he goes. And he uttered a declaration of independence for cyberspace. was part of our meetings, but it may have faded in the memory. And I just wanted you to hear it again and hear what a difference 4 years can make. We have a declaration.
This is the Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mine. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. We have no elected government, nor are we likely to have one, so I address you with no greater authority than that with which liberty itself always speaks. I declare the global social space we are building to be naturally independent of the tyrannies you seek to impose on us. You have no moral right to rule us, nor do you possess any methods of enforcement. We have true reason to fear. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. You have neither solicited nor received ours. We did not invite you.
Are you there?
You do not know us, nor do you know our world. Cyberspace does not lie within your borders. Do not think that you can build it. As though it were a public construction project, you can't. It is an act of nature, and it grows itself through our collective actions. You have not engaged our great and gathering conversations, nor did you create the wealth of our marketplaces. You do not know our culture, our ethics, or the unwritten codes that already provide our society more order than could be obtained by any of your impositions. You claim there are problems among us that you need to solve. You use this claim as an excuse to invade our precincts. Many of these problems do not exist. Where there are real conflicts, where there are wrongs, we will identify them and address them by our own means. We are forming our own social contract. This governance will arise according to the conditions of our world, not yours. Our world is different. Cyberspace consists of transactions, relationships, and thought itself, arrayed like a standing wave in the web of our communications. Ours is a world that is both everywhere and nowhere, but it is not where bodies live. We are creating a world that all may enter without privilege or prejudice accorded by race, economic power, military force, or station of birth. We are creating a world where anyone, anywhere, may express his or her beliefs, no matter how singular, without fear of being coerced into silence or conformity. Your legal concepts of property, expression, identity, movement, and context do not apply to us. They are all based on matter, and there is no matter here. Our identities have no bodies, so unlike you, we cannot obtain order by physical coercion. We believe that through ethics, enlightened self-interest, and the common weal, our governance will emerge. Our identities may be distributed across many of your jurisdictions. The only law that all our constituent cultures will generally recognize is the golden rule. We hope we will be able to build our particular solutions on that basis. But we cannot accept the solutions you are attempting to impose. In the United States, you have today created a law, the Telecommunications Reform Act, which repudiates your own constitution and insults the dreams of Jefferson, Washington, Mill, Madison, de Tocqueville, and Brandeis. These dreams must be born anew in us. You are terrified of your own children, since they are natives in a world where you will always be immigrants. Because you fear them and would trust your bureaucracies with the parental responsibilities,
So that was truly a voice from the past. When he first uttered those words, people were actually afraid. I mean, some people heard it, but most of the people that, you know, you get to know the Summer Association, were afraid. But they were paid by people who were afraid. And it seemed an inevitability. He dared use the word contagion to express what the internet was going to do. And he said, China, forget it. You can try a little bit to hold it back, but if you're going to let it in at all, you're going to let it all in. And that's the end of the story. He was trying to rise. Professor Nesson sometimes invokes Lincoln's question at Gettysburg. Right? What did Lincoln say at Gettysburg? He said, are we capable of governing ourselves? And Barlow was saying, hell yeah. And we know who we are, too. And we are the people that most people don't work for summer associationships at law firms. In just 4 short years, Barlow's words have gone from chilling and powerful and resonating with a certain basic truth to quaint and interesting and idealistic and naive. The internet today, even, forget about just the technologies of control we've been talking about. The typical activity that one of those people in the crowd engages in, yeah, maybe it's ripping off music. And I suppose Barlow has a grim smile about that, just because he likes to cause trouble. But he was thinking of the civilization of the mind in cyberspace. He was not thinking of Metallica for everyone. He was thinking of moves and muds and avatars and communities forming around different ideas. And that is sort of a sideline. In fact, it's a part of some cyber law syllabi that I don't even feature here because it's interesting. But it's not really where the internet's at. It's not bearing on those people's realities. So if Barlow has been eclipsed a little bit, and who knows, it's not over yet, but if his vision has been eclipsed, what is the vision that's replacing it? Well, maybe it's a little bit the idea in Singapore, still, you know, not all that serious, but the idea that you get a business connection in Singapore, you get the whole internet because you can be trusted with it. You get a consumer connection, they filter out some sites. A token, 100 sites you're not allowed to go to, which could turn into 200 or 300 or more. And if you try to go around it, maybe they would find you and put your corporeal being in jail. And if you're given a laptop in there, you may find your life somewhat diminished. And they find in China the use of cyber cafes where somebody walks behind you and just takes a look, just as somebody might do if you're in a public library that opts not to use filtering. You might find your behavior changed, nonetheless, for fear or social disapprobation, or worse. So what is, then, part of this new future? I guess Mike's supposed to be reading the building slides. Is it? There's not much left, that says plaintively. You should be happy there's not much left, right? So turning to our open questions, then, what are some of my answers to these questions? And I think the left and the right are going to speak to us a little, aren't they? The digital divide. Let's interpose that question for a moment, because it is actually one thing we didn't talk about as a formal class session. And that was definitely a conscious decision on my part not to feature it as a subject. And there are a few reasons why. If I were to try to feature it as a class session, these are the questions I would start to ask. Is there one? And it turns out that the question of whether there is a digital divide, at least one distinct from general economic divide, is not clear. There are people that don't have money, and as a result, don't have 486s or pennies or anything else. Oddly, there's not a television divide. Televisions are still a couple hundred bucks. Television penetration, particularly in poor areas, is near 100% in the United States. And to be sure, there's not television penetration everywhere in the world. When we think of digital divide, we somehow think of people missing out on more with the internet than they would on television if there were a television divide. Well, another thing might be, is there anybody happy about it? Is there anybody who actually wants to see a digital divide? Well, what are some candidates? For one thing, if what you think is on the other side of the divide is the internet of today, yeah, there are plenty of people, right? My whole beginning to this lecture was the sense of when the crowds moved in, that's when the panic set in. It was the digital divide that made it so that Jack Valenti did not have to dedicate a whole lot of his time to dealing with protection of digital media in a networked environment. As the digital divide gets crossed, he's got bigger worries. That's what leads me then to the third question, what will bridge it? And by that, I don't mean what particular UN development program will throw hundreds of millions of dollars at the problem to give people computers and hope that they will come up. I mean, what will the underlying forces be, the kind of tectonic economic forces that will start to get internet and technology as ubiquitous as television is now? And these are some of the things I see that must be on that one. Ah, yes. Remember the QCAT? That was the cat that was really a mouse, and we could scan things with it. And it was, as we saw, the evil basis for the drug lining to take place, even though it seemed so innocent and nice. QCAT has since gone mobile, since our class. QCAT has teamed up with Cross, the pen people. You might remember from some happy event, you got a bunch of these Cross pens that don't really work so well, they're in a drawer somewhere. So Cross is here, and the web at the tip of your pen. Now, at last, you can take your Cross pen, walk through Home Depot, and scan things. And the pen might alert you that you got a discount right then and there. And others won't get the discount right then and there. Webmining has now crossed the digital divide. No longer do you need a browser and Amazon.com in order to decode it at a different price for a DVD. You can do it in the store, too. Suddenly, everything you buy, a loaf of bread, can be subject to the forces that we thought were IT-related forces. That's one way of crossing the digital divide. What is another way? Is it more on this one, maybe? Ah, yes. On the top is the state-of-the-art Dell, looking quite nice. And those aren't two champagne glasses. I think those are speakers of some kind. On the right and left of the Dell. Underneath is the TiVo. We haven't talked much about the TiVo, although we had that New York Times Magazine article about it. The TiVo was a new way of watching television. TiVo was owned partly by NBC, as you saw. They're hedging their bets. The Bundy Whip might as well get some piece of the Model T. And just look at the thing. It's beautiful, right? It's sleek. Where are the buttons? Where's the monitor? There isn't one. It's just an object. It sits in your house. And the thing that you're working with looks pretty much like this. That's it. You're not going to be creating a civilization of the mind with this, I dare say. You'll be watching TV in an entirely new way. You'll be aiming out commercials. Or will you? That's the case to be decided between NBC and TiVo and Replay, and people making these devices. But the one thing that I believe will not be held constant, and mind you, this is just a personal prediction, is that the primary vehicle of getting onto the global internet will not be the personal computer. And by that, I just don't mean, yeah, you know, your cell phone can sometimes surf the web. I mean the essence of the personal computer is its genericity. The fact that it's a generic object you buy, and you turn it on, and you stare at a desktop that is inherently useless, and you're supposed to click on something to make something happen. And anybody can sell you or download to you, indeed, what is a virus, but an unsolicited offering of code that can run on your desktop. You can do anything with your computer so long as you write code for it. And even in the so-called closed code, the Microsoft operating system is documented so that anybody with enough knowledge or enough money to hire somebody with knowledge can write code that runs on the thing. And in the middle of the network, we have what's called end-to-end neutrality. And I included that paper about end-to-end neutrality in recent meetings. It at first was a very technical statement. End-to-end neutrality was the idea that you wanted the internet protocols in the middle to be as dumb as possible, as simple as possible. Just route the packets. And the byproduct of that would be that on the endpoints you have software that would know what to do. And there were technical reasons for this that I won't go into. But there's now a contingent of people who have taken it up to say, maybe there is political significance to this as well. Because when a network is dumb in the middle, when it just passes packets and doesn't inquire, wait, where are they coming from, where are they going to, are these legal packets or illegal packets, you have the maximum freedom to design stuff on the endpoints. You can take that personal computer and Nutella version 0.94, which can fit onto a floppy disk, can suddenly be spread like a contagion from one computer to the next. That's the current model. Now there's reason to think that end-to-end is ending. Paul Bixby is ending end-to-end with his real-time black hole list, because suddenly some emails are more equal than others, and some packets, and then the packet level, are more equal than others. Time and order is ending end-to-end, when it says that uploads go more slowly than downloads, or that some downloads will go faster than other downloads. They have every legal right to say this. It's their network. And indeed, as we saw when we moved into Marshby, Alabama, and its applicability, whether to Paul Bixby or to the Intel meeting case, what is the internet but a bunch of private networks that formerly had been acting in a fairly public-y sort of way, but not necessarily anymore. We see incentives lining up, whether the jihad incentives of Paul Bixby, or the strategic, predictable Soviet Union, rational incentives of Time Warner. Just to pick on one, there are plenty more of Time Warner comes from. Lining up to end-to-end. And that's why when I say it's the T-vote, I don't just mean it's a simpler thing to use. I think that the era of anybody being able to write software that can communicate over the internet to any destination point, I believe is ending. And with that, then, we'll go Nutella or other creative things to hack your machine, whether involuntarily, as a security. Can you imagine your TV getting hacked one day? You went to channel 68, the cable access channel, and suddenly you put on a program that messed up your TV. And not just for that moment, but you turn it on the next day and it's still screwed up. And somebody tells you, oh, you have to wipe your TV clean and reinitialize it and call it. Yeah, you wouldn't accept that in appliance. You don't want Mr. Coffee to just break at some point because some particular kind of bean was buggy. And yet, that's what we have accepted in personal computers, and what we will not be asked to accept any longer. The new PCs will be TiVos. You can't easily hack a TiVo. There are people that do it. I did TiVo and hack on Google and you'll see them. They're crazy. You're taking screwdrivers and then popping the hood. You have to do it at just the right instant to take out one drive and put another. So there are a few people who will do this. These are truly like the Robert De Niro character in Brazil, who kind of comes in and kicks down the air conditioning system and then runs away and then you people plummets afterwards as to what he did. When I say the future is TiVo, that's what I mean. And the deals then are simply being cut among the relevant parties to figure out what will the endpoints look like, how much are you going to pay for them, what will they do? And don't think you're going to hack it any more than you can hack your VCR to better accept DVDs getting played when they have the macrovision protection on them. That's the future. The PC is an aberration. The PC is a Barlow. It's not just an aberration, I love it dearly, but is an artifact of the past. It just hasn't realized its time has ended. So when you talk to your grandkids some days, I remember the PC. It was this weird thing. You could run stuff on it, a platform. I think you'll be telling them about a very different era. Just as the way now, I mean, I guess there are different applications for electricity. There are things you can plug into the wall and run them. But they're still pretty much short of the 701 electronic project kit, the Radio Shack, which is designed not to do anything that you could really hurt or help anything with. They're designed to be designed by people from underwriters' laboratories or friends of theirs, not by you or by some smartasses at MIT who think they know what's best in that. That's sort of the future I see. And the paradox of it is that if we don't want that future to come now, and I don't know, I kind of like these things myself, but I'm still thinking hard about this. If we don't want that future to come about, it would require actually some form of regulation. It would require the law to step in and to do something about it. To say, I'm sorry, Paul, you're not allowed to put these people on your bad list, even though it seems totally reasonable for you to do so. Certainly, if you're right, just keep a list of people you don't like, that's why you can do the reason not to like them. Or to tell Intel that they must accept emails on their server from this bozo, Ken Meany, disrupting their work, but it's their server. Who says they have to accept it? That's like telling China that they have to take subversive speech just because they want to allow economic data to come in over the internet. Now, there are all sorts of legal doctrines that we're not going to talk about, whether it's public accommodation doctrine, secondary boycott doctrine, antitrust doctrine, trustless doctrine, all sorts of stuff you can try to use. And indeed, I guess you might call it dormant First Amendment doctrine, if it's Marshall, Alabama. I'll just make that up, so please don't tell anybody else on that. You can come up with ways to try to push it, but remembering what we saw about law before, how hesitant it is to act unless there's a clear and present danger asserted by a clear and present party. And it's not out of kilter with the facts of reality, so you don't have law saying you've got to do what isn't the case, is quite difficult. So this is definitely a challenge at a moment of a point of inflection where I don't know what the future is. I mean, this UCAP 10, it looks too schlocky to be ubiquitous, right? But you know, I used to think the same thing about a number of schlocky and ubiquitous items that exist today, including logomics, which I handle. So, oh yeah, I asked the question, what do you princess phone? This is a weird way of trying to encapsulate the entire course into a single question that doesn't seem to be related to any of it. But will your princess phone ever encrypt? That's the one we said we haven't talked about, like the encryption that they spent a day or 2 months. It's one thing for the government not to care that much that with enough trouble you can get PGP 6.0 to work and maybe encrypt an email and then decide it's not really worth it, so once you've done one, you don't do it anymore. Or maybe you find out how to do it, but you still end up doing most of your crime or surveillable activity over the telephone. The day that the government really worries when the masses have arrived is when there's that princess phone with the key in the middle. And you just press the key, and if somebody has that princess phone on the other side with the same model, boom, anybody in the middle can no longer understand the conversation in the middle. It is entirely possible to build phones like that right now, that all the power of the National Security Agency and its international counterparts cannot break, and yet they do not exist, at least for us. And I don't believe they ever will. Because the people in the position to make the phones, now we're talking hardware, now we're talking customer return policy, now we're talking, you know, QCAT, the violence, the Radio Shack, they're not going to let it happen. Now, I don't know if that's a bad thing. I'm all in favor of catching criminals who say bad things on the phone. It seems that our prosecutorial systems have atrophied the presence of surveillance, so we often hard to substitute other more alert firefighting techniques for just listening to phone calls, should that go away. But when we talk about the technology of control, realize what's on and maybe off the table. And if we talk about the internet, I even think that it's the end of the net. It's going to be the end of the net the way we've had the end of the power grid. It's not as if the power grid is up for political discussion now. It's just a background fact of life. There's rules about what happens in the middle and rules about what happens on the end. And I believe those same rules, or a similar kind of set of rules, are coming into play for the internet as well. So that to answer the question of, is there a cyber law? There is right now. And I mean, oddly, I think this is it. If you're looking at cyber law, asking the meta questions about what the policy line should be when the technology substitutes for the law, not only in individual instances, but in the meta instance of controlling the future of the internet. And I don't know if that question would be on the table or anything, but in a truly academic way, 5 years hence. So I think I teach this course and take this course at a fortunate and interesting time. And it certainly suggests, as you still, I guess, and I don't plan on being this over, but I guess interviews and such continues, as you think about where you're going, whether it's to a .com, to advise them, there are many ways, especially now with the shakeout, that the Harvard brand carries more power than it used to. But if you're going into policy or into the public interest side of things, realize there really is a tectonic movement afoot, at least I believe so, and one for which it's not inevitable the way it's going to go, but it's certainly going to require a lot of better understanding of this process, and certainly a formulation of the right forward policies. End-to-end, for example, is something we want to preserve in order to make it happen. So I'm actually I can't quite believe I've just left it solid for basically an hour and 15 minutes. I believe I should stop. I believe it's time, for one thing, thanks to people, not only Ben who returned, and John Coakley and Becca Nesson. Experimental aspects of this class, not knowing whether on a panel or off panel, or whether the rotisserie thing is due Sunday night or Tuesday, that kind of thing. I hope you found certainly the willingness and flexibility of this side of things to account for the inevitable issues that have come up. And I hope that I'll cross paths with many of you again. I'd like to create actually an IS alums list, so as it goes from IS 97, 98, and 99. To join the mailing list, which you'll then regret having joined. It's also a trend. But to join the mailing list of people who have been through this bill and have advanced many of them through years which are relevant directly to it. And for those of you who are as well, perhaps I'll have a chance to encounter you next year or if I haven't again. Please get you off supervising through your paper at some time. So with all that done, I guess that's all I have to say. I have to run to a conference actually tonight. So that's why that's not my belief. But that's okay because John has to distribute the DSA forms, right? The last feedback level of the term. So there's that. That has to happen. Ben's going to put some music on. There's no reception since I'm not here. Although for the record, I did not get one scallop after making or any other form of food last night. And I was told that several people were seen fleeing the room with piles of food on plates. Which is not creating a civilization of the mind in this classroom, but so be it. So, thank you all again for a wonderful.